that this incident be assessed E, probably slightly damaged.
Wait a minute, Kohler said. The grade on this attack report says B, probably sunk.
Yeah, but look here, Chatterton said, pointing to the report. The original grade of E is crossed out. Someone changed it to a B. The divers knew what the alteration meant.
Son of a bitch, Kohler said. The post-war assessors upgraded this report.
Chatterton and Kohler had only recently learned about the post-war assessors. As Navy investigators, it was the assessors' task after the war to make a final report on the fate of all U-boats. In most cases, the evidence was clear-cut and the assessors' job simple. In rarer instances, when a U-boat could not be accounted for, the assessors stretched for an explanation. They were loath to leave question marks in the history books.
That must have been what happened here, Chatterton said. The Gustafsson never sank U-857. The U-boat survived the Hedgehog attack, continued past Boston, then sank somewhere else. After the war, the assessors needed an explanation for the loss of U-857. So they looked at this really dubious attack by the Gustafsson and said, "Let's upgrade it from an E to a B." They didn't care that the original Navy assessors knew the Gustafsson hadn't sunk a submarine. They just wanted U-857 accounted for so they could move on with their business. For a moment, the divers could only shake their heads.
"Well, if the Gustafsson didn't sink U-857 off Boston," Kohler finally asked, "what happened to that submarine?"
"We gotta figure that out for ourselves," Chatterton said.
The divers checked various German documents. An hour later, they had their answer. According to German diaries, U-857 had been ordered to proceed south along the American East Coast. She had last attacked a ship off Cape Cod. That meant New York and New Jersey lay 200 miles away, to the south. Neither Chatterton nor Kohler could move. Here was a U-boat that fit every criterion they had established, had possibly been docked beside Horenberg's sub, had likely survived the Gustafsson, and was believed by the Germans to be on her way toward New Jersey.
"It's got to be U-857, Chatterton said.
"I think we've got our U-boat," Kohler said.
The divers, however, still had to inspect the box of files for U-879. Again, they found history mauled. Over the last half-century, various assessors had ascribed three fates to U-879. They first pronounced her lost without a trace, then sunk off Halifax in Canadian waters, then sunk off Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. As the divers studied further, they recognized that the current assessment by German naval historian Axel Nesli, that U-879 had been sunk off Cape Hatteras, was correct. But the lesson was stark and by now familiar. Written history was fallible. Sloppy and erroneous assessments had been rushed into the official record, only to be presumed accurate by historians, who then published elegant reference works echoing the mistakes. Unless a person was willing, as Chatterton and Kohler were, to ditch work and sneak off to Washington, chisel away at mountains of opaque original documents, sleep in flea-bag motels, eat street vendor hot dogs, and run outside every 2 hours to shovel quarters into a parking meter, he would presume the history books to be correct. As they left Washington for New Jersey that night, Chatterton and Kohler celebrated their detective work, original research that virtually proved that the Yoo-hoo was U-857. Along the way, each marveled at how easy it was to get an incomplete picture of the world if one relied solely on experts, and how important it would be to further rely on oneself. Now armed with abundant evidence that their wreck was U-857, Chatterton and Kohler determined to use the rest of the 1992-93 off-season to complete the proof. For his part, Chatterton placed a classified ad in Proceedings magazine, a publication of the U.S. Naval Institute,
seeking information on the sinking of U-857 by the USS Gustafsson. Several Gustafsson crewmen, now in their 70s, replied to the ad. Chatterton interviewed them about the day they attacked the U-boat off Boston. While the accomplishment had been a source of lifelong pride, none could offer any more evidence of the sinking today than they had in 1945. They had fired hedgehogs and smelled oil. And that was it. Chatterton did not have the heart to inform these men, soldiers who had gone to hunt U-boats in defense of America, that the sinking of which they had been proud for so long had likely never happened. During one interview, a crewman invited Chatterton to their upcoming Greasy Gus reunion. He asked Chatterton to speak about his research. As Chatterton considered the invitation, he was struck by the oddest thought. He had run to fallen men in Vietnam bullet storms. He had swum under 1,000 pounds of dangling steel inside a crushed submarine. But contemplating speaking before these elderly men at their celebration, he found himself afraid. He felt sure that he could not attend their reunion and tell these men that the story they had told their grandchildren about sinking the U-boat was wrong, that history had been mistaken, that the Greasy Gus had missed. Chatterton thanked the crewman for the invitation, but told him he would be unable to attend. For his part, Kohler set out in search of the Grand Master of U-boat knowledge. For decades, Robert Koppick had been caretaker to Britain's U-boat records, including captured German records, and he still worked for the Ministry of Defense in London. According to an archivist Kohler had met, no one had a more comprehensive understanding of U-boat records than did Koppick. And no one had deeper connections into the sometimes murky world of U-boat historians, thinkers, and theorists. "He still works his job?" Kohler asked. "Since forever," the archivist replied. Kohler called London the next day. An English-accented woman, speaking over pillows of static, answered the telephone. "Scotland Yard, can I help you?" Kohler believed he had misdialed, but did not dare hang up. The idea of being connected to the legendary crime-fighting headquarters was too thrilling to abandon. For a moment he just listened to the static, imagining men scurrying in deerstalker hats, crying, "It's murder!" "This is Scotland Yard. Is anyone on the line?" Kohler finally said, "I must have the wrong number. I was trying to reach Mr. Robert Koppick at the Ministry of Defense." "One moment, and I'll connect you to Mr. Koppick," the woman said. Kohler was beside himself waiting for Koppick. This was the first time he had ever spoken to anyone with an English accent. Across the Atlantic, in a cavernous office lined with floor-to-ceiling gray filing cabinets, institutional furniture, and frosted windows, the silver-haired Koppick settled in among his U-boat history and took the phone. Kohler introduced himself. "Ah, yes, the diver from New Jersey," Koppick said. "I know of you, sir. I have been following your adventure with great interest. I find the mystery most intriguing." Koppick asked detailed questions of Kohler about the diver's research, the U-Hoo, the contacts they had made, about Horenburg. Kohler answered them all, flattered that Koppick spoke to him as a colleague rather than as a guy from Brooklyn late to replace a window at a Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise, which he was. When Koppick asked if the divers had fashioned any theories, Kohler laid out the case for U-857. Koppick listened intently, then agreed that Kohler had made a persuasive argument for U-857 as the New Jersey wreck. He asked if Kohler would like him to consult his records and sources and look into the matter further. Kohler nearly blurted, "Hell yeah!" Instead, he managed, "Yes, sir, I'd be grateful for that kind of help. Thank you very much." As he sped to fix the window at KFC, Kohler called Chatterton from his truck. "John, I talked to Koppick. The guy must be 75 years old, but he's totally on the ball. And he works at friggin' Scotland Yard. What did he say? Chatterton asked. You're killing me here. I laid out the case for U-857. He said it sounded persuasive. He really liked it. He's going to look into it on his end.
Beautiful, Chatterton said. What an amazing adventure we're on.
That's what it is, Kohler said. An amazing adventure.
Shortly after Kohler spoke to Koppick, the divers contacted Horst Bredow and Charlie Grutzemacher in Germany and made the case for U-857. Each of the archivists absorbed the evidence, pulled out his own records, asked a few questions, then agreed. The Yoo-Hoo almost certainly was U-857. Kohler redialed Scotland Yard, really Great Scotland Yard, a different place from the fabled police station, to follow up with Koppick. This conversation was brief. Koppick told Kohler that he had consulted records and considered further the divers' theory. As before, he believed it likely that the divers had discovered U-857. As the early months of 1993 wore on, Chatterton and Kohler continued to meet for steaks or pizza. They no longer speculated, however, about the Yoo-Hoo's identity. That question was settled. Instead, they began to imagine how the U-boat had met its end. By now they had conferred with several munitions experts. All evidence pointed in a single direction. The U-boat had been destroyed by a massive explosion, the kind most likely caused by a torpedo. But whose torpedo? If an Allied sub had fired on the U-boat, there would have been a record of the incident. If another U-boat had fired and inadvertently hit the sub, that too would have been recorded. Could one of the U-boat's own torpedoes have exploded accidentally from within? Impossible, as the blast damage showed a strike from outside the sub. That seemed to leave a single explanation. The divers had read about occasions in which a torpedo steering system malfunctioned, causing the weapon to reverse direction in the water and head back toward its own submarine. Those derelict torpedoes were called circle runners and had turned on several of their own U-boats. Imagine you're Rudolf Premauer, commander of U-857, Kohler said to Chatterton one night at Scotty's. You've made it through icy waters and past swarms of Allied aircraft all the way from Norway to the United States. You've narrowly escaped a hunter-killer group off Boston, and now you're in New Jersey, a few miles from Manhattan. You spot a target steaming in the distance. You order your men to their battle stations, climb into the conning tower, and raise the attack periscope. You've got your target locked. You give the order. Fire torpedo. The torpedo flies out of the tube. Everyone's silent and hopeful, waiting for an explosion in the distance. Nothing happens. Then, from the sound room, the radio man says, "Circle runner! We have a circle runner! Our torpedo is bearing down on us!" Premauer orders the sub to crash dive. It's their only hope. Now it's a race, the U-boat against her own torpedo. And there's only one question. Can the U-boat submerge before the torpedo strikes? The men are doing everything humanly possible to drop that boat. Do they have 20 seconds? 5 seconds? They don't know. They give it everything they've got. Too late. The torpedo hits. Several hundred pounds of TNT. It's too goddamn late.
And that explains why there's no incident report from the area, Chatterton said. It's probably night. It's winter.
When the torpedo hits the U-boat, no one on the target vessel is going to hear it because it occurs underwater. And even if they do hear a muffled explosion, hell, it's wartime. Muffled explosions are everywhere. The U-boat sinks, and no one has a clue she went down. For a minute, each diver poked at his food, but said nothing.
Imagine the feeling that radio guy has the moment he realizes the torpedo's coming back, Kohler said.
Imagine the certainty that either your life will end violently in a few seconds, or the circle runner's going to miss, Chatterton said. There's no middle ground. You know it's one or the other. The next morning, Chatterton searched through the piles of crew lists he had copied at Brennau's archive in Germany. On the bottom was that of U-857. He scanned the roster. 59 men with names like Dienst and Kausler, Lofgren and Wolf. Some of these men were 19 or 20 years old. The senior radioman was Erich Krahe, born on March 14, 1917. If a circle runner torpedo had killed this U-boat, perhaps he had been the first to realize it was coming. Kohler searched his books for photographs of 25-year-old Commander Premauer. Chatterton and Kohler still had 2 months before the start of the 1993 dive season. Time enough to learn about the last year of the U-boat war. The year that had delivered the men they had discovered. By 1993, Kohler had built a collection of U-boat books worthy of a university library. Now he spread those books on his living room floor like a kid's baseball card collection and divided them in half. He would lend Chatterton one pile for study and keep the other for himself. Between them, they held in their hands the story of the men who'd waged the final campaign of the U-boat war, the men who lay dead in their wreck. Chatterton and Kohler settled into their reading chairs at home and began with page 1. Primitive submarines had existed during the American Revolution. Each fidgeted with page 2. The torpedo was invented by an English engineer in 1866. Neither waited around for page 3. The divers needed to know what had happened to their men. They flipped their books to the final chapters. They found hundreds of pages soaked in blood. By the war's end, more than 30,000 U-boat men out of a force of about 55,000 had been killed, a death rate of almost 55%. No branch of a modern nation's armed forces had ever sustained such casualties and kept fighting. The U-boats had kept fighting. But it was worse than that. The late war U-boat man, it turned out, had had it perhaps deadliest of all. A U-boat sent to war in early 1945, as U-857 had been, stood only a 50% chance of returning from its patrol. A crewman's statistical life expectancy in that period was barely 60 days. Those ordered to American or Canadian waters almost never came back. Over the years, the divers had read dozens of war books, but none had affected them as deeply as the final pages of these volumes. As Chatterton and Kohler pored over the body counts, they found themselves hoping for a better ending. Not for the Nazis or for Germany, but maybe for a crewman or two. For one of these kids whose shoes were lined up neatly on the mangled Yoo-hoo. And when the divers could not find hope for the late war U-boat man, they called each other and agreed that they had never turned a book's pages like this because they'd never before felt as if they had been reading about men they knew. By nearly every account, the late war U-boat man had not just fought through the final hours of World War II, but had done so nobly and bravely, all the while knowing the grim odds against his survival. The Allies had predicted mutinies aboard these doomed U-boats. That never happened. The Allies had expected surrender from these doomed U-boats. That never happened either. In January 1945, even as the Allies hunted and killed U-boats with unflinching regularity, Churchill summoned top military commanders and warned them of the much more offensive spirit displayed by U-boats at sea. It was this idea, that the beaten U-boat man was doing more than just trying to survive, that kept Chatterton and Kohler reading. In October 1940, at the peak of what German submariners called the happy time, U-boats sank 66 ships while losing only one of their own. The U-boats enjoyed a second happy time in early 1942 with Operation Drumbeat, a surprise attack on American ships off the U.S. East Coast.
In that offensive, U-boats pushed up against American shores so closely that crewmen could smell the forest from their decks, watch automobiles drive the parkways, and tune in American radio stations playing the jazz so many of them loved. The first weeks of drumbeat were a slaughter as U-boats torpedoed unprotected ships. Body parts, oil, and wreckage washed up along the eastern seaboard. 5 months later, just a few U-boats had sunk nearly 600 ships in American waters at a cost of just 6 of their own, the worst defeat ever suffered by the U.S. Navy. In Germany, U-boats were welcomed back to harbor by bands, flowers, and lovely ladies. Churchill wrote, "The only thing that ever really frightened me during the war was the U-boat peril." It was no longer safe to be Goliath in a world where David could turn invisible. The Americans, however, did not remain vulnerable for long. The Navy began running convoys, an ancient maritime strategy whereby armed escort vessels protected groups of boats sailing together. Now, when a U-boat fired on an Allied ship, the convoy escorts would be there to spot, chase, and kill it. As convoys increased, sinkings by U-boats dropped to near nothing. Scientists joined the war effort from U.S. laboratories and universities. One of their most potent weapons was radar. Even in total darkness or a violent storm, radar-equipped airplanes and ships could detect a surfaced submarine at great distances. While submarines had long enjoyed the luxury of operating primarily on the surface, where subs moved considerably faster than they could while submerged, they suddenly found themselves pounced upon by Allied aircraft that seemed to appear in the sky as if by magic. For a time, Carl Dönitz, the commander-in-chief of the U-boat force, did not fully appreciate the radar threat. His submariners continued to die. Even when Germany finally grasped the situation's gravity, the U-boats could do little but submerge and stay underwater, which protected them from radar but made them too slow to catch or evade enemies. The underwater environment presented its own perils. An Allied ship that suspected there was a submerged U-boat in its vicinity could use sonar, the broadcast of sound waves, to sniff it out. Once sonar echoed off the submarine's metallic form, a U-boat was tagged for death. Unable to outrun the enemy while underwater, a fish in a barrel if it chose to surface and fight it out with its guns. U-boats relied on radio to communicate with German headquarters. Allied brains pounced on the dependence. They developed a radio detection system known as HFDF, for HFDF, or high-frequency direction finding, that allowed Allied ships at sea to fix the position of U-boats. Now a submarine using its radio, even to report the weather, was as much as announcing its location to the enemy. The Allies wasted little time dispatching hunter-killer groups to U-boats so exposed. Perhaps the deadliest Allied breakthrough came in the form of code-breaking. Since the war's beginning, the German military had encrypted its communications through a cipher machine known as Enigma. A boxy, typewriter-like device capable of millions of character combinations, Enigma was believed by the German high command to be invincible, the strongest code ever created. Allied codebreakers estimated the odds against a person cracking Enigma without knowing the code to be 150 quintillion to one. They tried anyway. Building on years of pioneering work by Polish cryptanalysts, and with the help of a captured Enigma machine and key documents, teams of cryptographers, mathematicians, Egyptologists, scientists, crossword puzzle experts, linguists, and chess champions spent months attacking Enigma, even building the world's first programmable computer to aid in the effort. The mental strain and pressure could have overwhelmed them. They kept at it. Months later, with the help of covert intelligence, they cracked it. one of the great intellectual achievements of the 20th century. By late 1943, the Allies were using intercepted Enigma messages to direct hunter-killer groups to unsuspecting U-boats. Dönitz suspected that Enigma could be compromised, but was constantly assured by experts that Enigma was unbreakable. The Allies continued to read the German mail. U-boats continued to die. By spring 1943, the fangs of Allied technology had encircled the U-boats, leaving no safe areas in the ocean. In May of that year, 41 U-boats were destroyed by Allied forces, a disaster that came to be known as Black May, and which Dönitz described as unimaginable even in my wildest dreams. The happy time had yielded to saure Gurkenzeit, or sour pickle time. The hunters of the early war had now become the hunted. By early 1945, U-boats stood a greatly reduced chance of inflicting damage or even surviving. Younger crews replaced the elite, hand-picked service that had threatened in the early war to dominate the world. Allied bombing devastated German cities. France had been lost. The Russian army had crossed onto German soil. Aboard the U-boat, surrounded by killers who might know its every move in advance, a U-boat crewman could not even dream of safe haven back home. His Germany was falling. As Chatterton and Kohler digested the late U-boat war, each discovered a new pride for Allied ingenuity and tenacity, for the ability of the United States to dig deep into its instinct for freedom, rise up against one of history's most terrifying threats, and pound it down until the world was safe again. Yet neither of them could put out of his mind the crewman lying dead in their wreck. They did not speak to wives or co-workers or friends about these thoughts. Instead, they made a plan to meet at Scotty's. The conversation that night was different from the others the divers had shared over dinner. Before, Chatterton and Kohler had talked in broad terms about research, theories, strategies, large thoughts about solving the U-Boat mystery. Now, educated in the hopelessness of the late U-boat war, they found themselves thinking on a smaller scale, a scale that envisioned the lives of men with whom they had become intertwined. Over and over they asked each other, how could these men have kept fighting? Part of the answer, for Chatterton and Kohler, lay in Dönitz's own characterization of a U-boat crew. He had called them a Schicksalgemeinschaft, a community bound by fate, in which each man is dependent on the other, and is thereby sworn to one another. To the divers, such a band of brotherhood seemed about the most noble of human instincts, and as they nursed after-dinner coffees, that instinct seemed also to describe their friendship. There was another answer, one that each of the divers had been contemplating, but about which neither spoke. Most men, it seemed to them, went through life never really knowing themselves. A man might consider himself noble, or brave, or just, they believed, but until he was truly tested, it would always be mere opinion. This, more than anything, is what moved the divers about the late war U-boat man. Despite knowing his efforts would be futile, he had gone to sea determined to strike a blow. As the divers said good night that evening, each wondered if he might not be moving toward the same kind of test. The U-Boat had already killed 3 divers. Chatterton and Kohler could back out now and abandon their search for conclusive identification. They already were certain of the sub's identity. But as each man drove home that night, he wondered, "What will that say about me if I quit? What will it mean if life tests me, and I do not try to strike a blow?" Chapter 11 A Missed Signal. In late May 1993, as the residents of Brielle rubbed winter from their eyes, the divers booked the Seeker for the season's first U-boat trip. By now, Chatterton and Kohler had taken to calling the wreck U-857, and even announcing their finding to dive show audiences. Many people asked the divers why they planned to continue searching such a dangerous wreck now that they had deduced its identity. The divers responded that until they pulled proof from the wreck, everything else was mere opinion. They had not come this far, they said, to stand on mere opinion. The first U-boat trip of 1993 was scheduled for May 31st, Memorial Day. As Chatterton and Kohler drove their cars to the Seeker's dock, neither could remember having felt so content. Chatterton had made every important discovery inside the wreck, and had gone places on the submarine no other diver had. He had been relentless in his research until his thinking had produced a solution even the world's great U-boat minds did not dispute. Kohler felt a similar satisfaction. 2 years ago he had been a ferocious tonnage king and Atlantic wreck diver's fundamentalist. He'd lived to haul shit and raise hell in between. But as he'd come to know the U-boat and feel its crew, as he'd watched Chatterton dedicate entire dives to shooting video for later study, as he'd done original research that had corrected written history, the jaws of habit had loosened, and he'd come to feel himself not just a diver, but an explorer, a passholder to the landing place of his childhood dreams. Not everyone celebrated this evolution. During the off-season, some of Kohler's Atlantic wreck divers' mates had lashed out at the betrayal. "So you're diving with your new buddies, are you?" they'd ask when Kohler found time to make their charters that spring. "How's it feel diving with that asshole who put up the grate on the Doria?" For a time, the criticism hurt Kohler. These friends had delivered him into deep wreck diving. Their guidance had kept him alive. Chatterton could see how deeply the barbs cut Kohler. He spoke up on those occasions. "Your friends have plans this season," Chatterton told Kohler. "Diving the Oregon again. Diving the San Diego again. What do they want, another plate from the Oregon? Another bowl like the one they got 12 bowls ago? That's bullshit, Richie. That's against the spirit of diving. You don't buy it. If you did, you wouldn't be diving the U-boat." Kohler always answered the same way. "You're right, John. Things have changed for me." Things had changed so much, in fact, that Kohler had dedicated part of his off-season to converting to Trimix. He had seen Chatterton's and Yerga's diving transformed by the safety and benefits offered by the new gas. And he believed the Rouses had died for a one-time decision to breathe air. Kohler had committed himself so fully, in fact, that he had given up smoking so he could optimize his abilities underwater. The parking lot at Brielle looked emptier than usual to the arriving divers, though none found himself surprised. If Feldman's death had suggested the Yoo-hoo's reputation as a death trap, the Rouse's demise had cemented it. Word in the diving community had it that there were 1,000 ways to die on this wreck, that if the depth didn't kill you, the sub's dangling steel or anarchy of wires would. The trip was expensive. $150 just for the ride. Mantle-worthy artifacts were virtually non-existent. The media had long since gone home. Divers capable of this depth wanted prizes, and they wanted to live. Most said no thanks to the Yoo-hoo. On board the Seeker, the gathered divers shook hands and compared off-season notes. Near midnight, a skeleton wobbled from the horrible inn toward the Seeker. No one spoke. The figure drew closer, feet dragging the dirt parking lot as it approached the pier. "That's Bill," someone whispered. Nagel's face was yellow from jaundice and splotched with purple bruises. His hair was oily and his T-shirt grimy. He weighed perhaps 120 pounds, skin dripping from his legs, the remaining bump of his pot belly the only evidence of a man of former appetites. Under his arm he carried the cowboys and Indians' sleeping bag he had used since boyhood, the one he'd brought along when he had taken the bell off the Andrea Doria in the days when he ruled the world. The divers screwed on their best faces. "Hiya, Bill," someone said.
"The Seeker's looking beautiful, Bill," said another.
As the boat left the dock that night, everyone on board gave thanks that Chatterton and Crowell, two capable and sober captains, were also on hand. As the Seeker steamed for the Yoo-Hoo, the divers made a final review of their strategies. Packer and Gatto, perhaps the country's finest wreck-diving team, would penetrate the diesel motor room. In addition to housing the submarine's massive diesel engines, this compartment contained gauge panels, telegraphs, and other equipment possibly engraved with the U-boat's identity. Until now, the diesel motor room had been inaccessible, its entrance blocked by massive air intake ductwork that had fallen from the upper casement of the submarine. Packer and Gatto, however, had prepared to forcibly remove the obstruction, even if it required using a rope and several lift bags, a risky operation in close quarters. Such access would yield an additional benefit. By gaining entry to the diesel motor room, the divers would also have a clear shot into the adjoining electric motor room, the only other remaining compartment inaccessible to divers. Chatterton's plan was simpler. He would return to the wreck's forward section, the radio room, sound room, commander's quarters, and officer's quarters, areas he had already explored. Once there, he would become nearly motionless. "This is a matter of seeing," he told Yerga on the boat. "This is a matter of looking at a big pile of garbage until one little thing in the pile starts to look a little different than the rest. I'm looking for a glimmer of order in the chaos. I think if I just start digging, I'm never going to see more than the pile. But if I just stay quiet and look long enough, I think I'll see something." Kohler's plan was similar. His off-season research had uncovered dozens of photographs in which U-boat crewmen held lighters or pocket watches or wore hats emblazoned with a U-boat number or logo. Like Chatterton, he believed important items would be located in the forward part of the wreck, where the crewmen had slept and stored their personal effects. Unlike Chatterton, however, he was willing to dig, trusting his hands to become his eyes in the black silt clouds raised by his activity, willing to reach anywhere he was certain did not contain human remains. The morning sun was a brilliant alarm clock. As they had the previous season, Chatterton and Kohler splashed together. Kohler inhaled his Trimix, the voodoo gas he had sworn would kill its heathen users. He continued living. At 100 feet, Kohler checked his mind for narcosis, and Chatterton checked Kohler, checking himself. No drums. At 200 feet, Kohler stopped on the anchor line to process the scene. On air at this depth, his vision would have already narrowed. Unbelievable, he thought. This is the difference between watching a portable kitchen TV and going to a movie theater. He flashed Chatterton an okay sign. Chatterton grinned. The two divers wriggled inside the wreck and swam forward toward the sections where so many crewmen had died, the section where vision would be key. Kohler penetrated farthest, landing in the non-commissioned officer's quarters, the place he knew as a boneyard. Chatterton settled into the commander's quarters. He had not said much to anyone, but he believed that he stood a chance of recovering the ship's log, the KTB, in this area. Artifacts with legible writing had survived shipwrecks older than this one, and the KTB would be the ultimate find. A first-person account of the sub's mission, targets, hopes, fears, and dying. If the KTB still existed, only quiet eyes would find it. Chatterton began to go still. At first, the wreckage in the commander's quarters appeared as the junk pile Chatterton expected. He settled in and absorbed the scene. Still junk. As minutes passed and he stayed locked on the scene, however,
Specks of order began to dance in and out of the chaos.
That shape is not random, Chatterton thought as he reached forward into the pile of rubble. He pulled out a pristine leather boot.
That speck of metal is smoother than the rest, he considered as he pushed his hand into another wreckage heap.
He pulled out a signal flare.
That brown is not from nature, he speculated, as he fidgeted his hand into a mound of splintered wood.
He pulled out a crewman's escape lung, complete with small oxygen tank, breathing apparatus, and vest.
In 20 minutes, Chatterton had salvaged 3 prime artifacts he had overlooked on earlier dives to these forward rooms. Each likely contained writing. The escape lung seemed the most promising. In Germany, Horst Bredow had urged the divers to recover this device, a mini-scuba tank and rubberized mouthpiece used by submariners to exit a sinking U-boat, because crewmen often wrote their names inside them. As Chatterton made his way up to the Seeker, he found himself unusually proud, though for most of the hour he could not put his finger on why. At 20 feet, when he saw the dive boat swaying above him, he understood. In detecting beauty camouflaged in wreckage, he had done the very thing that had made Nagel great, and it had always been his dream to dive like Bill Nagel. When Chatterton climbed aboard, Nagel dragged himself over to inspect the artifacts. Chatterton could smell his body odor and see the dirt in his hair. He put his arm around Nagel and asked the captain to help him undress. It was a good feeling, Chatterton thought, to still dream to dive like Nagel. Kohler followed Chatterton onto the boat and threw off his tanks. He had recovered only some pieces of a coffee pot, so he rushed to the dive table to join in the inspection of Chatterton's finds. The divers placed the leather boot, the flare, and the escape lung in a bucket of fresh water and sloshed them around. Nagel removed the boot first and dabbed a towel at the grime. The divers crowded in, each of them looking for a name or initials or other writing. The boot was barren. Its owner had written nothing. Next, Nagel pulled the shotgun shell-shaped flare from the bucket. This is what the crewman would have fired into the air from a pistol in case of distress. He rubbed it in soft, genie lamp circles. German writing appeared in answer. The words, however, provided just a manufacturer's name and the flare's gauge size. Only the escape lung remained. It consisted of a brownish, rubberized canvas life vest, a black corrugated rubber tube, an orange rubber mouthpiece, and a thermosized aluminum oxygen cylinder, from which crewmen could breathe in emergencies. Of the 3 artifacts, it was in the worst condition. Much had eroded in the ocean environment. The oxygen bottle was dented in the middle and bent out of alignment. Nagel wiped at the apparatus. Mud fell away. There was no writing. Nagel rubbed further. This time, from the handle of the mouthpiece, a tiny eagle and swastika materialized.
"Is there a name written anywhere?" Kohler asked.
Nagel wiped some more.
"No name," Nagel said. "Looks like it could have belonged to any of 'em."
Chatterton's hopes drifted off the Seeker and evaporated in the mid-morning breeze.
0 for 3, he said. "This wreck is one tough SOB."
He took the escape lung and placed it in his cooler.
"May as well take it home, clean it, and let it dry," he told Jurga. "Who knows? Maybe I'll see some writing if I let the canvas dry completely."
At the ladder, Packer and Gatto surfaced with promising news. The fallen ductwork that had blocked entry to the diesel motor room had disappeared during the off-season, a gift from a winter storm. Inside, the team had seen several instruments and pieces of equipment, any one of which might be engraved with the U-boat's number. Another dive, and they would have time to begin inspection.
"How much of the diesel motor room did you see?" Kohler asked.
"Not much," Packer said. "We only got about 10 feet inside. There's another huge obstruction that blocks the rest of the way. You still can't reach the electric motor room. But I think we got in far enough to hit it big."
"Congrats," Chatterton said. "I think you guys have done it."
Rough seas and plummeting visibility cut short most of the second dives. As Nagel pulled up anchor and coaxed the boat to life, many of the divers fantasized aloud about the wonders Packer and Gatto would yank from the diesel motor room when next they got the chance. At first, Chatterton led the discussion, recounting the treasures he had seen in the same room on U-505 in the Chicago Museum. But as the divers kept talking, Chatterton fell quiet, looking instead at his cooler and imagining the tattered escape lung inside, wondering if there might be order inside that broken artifact, and wondering about this U-boat in which nothing was exactly as it seemed. Chatterton returned home from the Memorial Day dive near midnight. He unpacked his gear quietly, careful not to awaken his wife. When only the cooler remained, he fished out the escape lung and walked it into his garage. Shelves everywhere held the overflow of shipwreck artifacts from Chatterton's house, making the garage a museum of his underwater daring. He found a spot for the battered lung alongside several years' bounty of Andrea Doria serving bowls, silverware, and china. He figured it would take several days for the piece to fully dry. Inside his house, Chatterton washed his face and thought, "Packer and Gatto are going to be the ones to recover proof of the wreck's identity." A few days later, Chatterton went to his garage to check on the escape lung. He stood dumbfounded at the door. Broken china lay strewn across the floor. Shattered glass had been shrapneled against the walls and ceiling. A thick wooden shelf lay broken and dangling.
"Someone blew up my garage," Chatterton said aloud. "Someone came in here with a bomb."
Dazed, he searched for a broom and began sweeping. Virtually nothing on the garage shelves had survived. He kept sweeping. In the rubble, he spotted a metallic silver shape. He picked it up. This was the escape lung's oxygen bottle, but it was no longer cylindrical and closed. Now it was flattened, like a toothpaste tube sliced open.
"God damn," Chatterton said. The oxygen bottle exploded. The thing was still live. The escape lung blew up my garage.
Chatterton looked closer at the flattened cylinder. The explosion had blasted away a half-century's encrustation, the part that could not be removed by simple wiping. Chatterton pulled it close to his face. Stamped onto the flattened metal was a bit of writing. It said, 15-4-44. Chatterton knew right away what the numbers meant. He ran into his home and called Kohler.
"Richie, man, the oxygen bottle blew up my garage," he said.
"What?"
"The escape lung. Remember the oxygen bottle? It was still charged. I let it dry in my garage. The corrosion must have caused it to blow. All my Doria stuff in the garage is destroyed. My garage is like a war zone. But listen to this. The explosion produced a clue. The bottle has a date on it. 15.4.44. That's European for April 15th, 1944. That's the hydrostatic test date, the date the bottle was examined and certified to be good.
That means our U-boat sailed after April 15th, 1944, Kohler said.
Exactly. I'll be right there.
Chatterton returned to the garage. He picked up the broom, but could not sweep. Only now did it occur to him how lucky he had been while handling the escape lung. He had carried the artifact in his goodie bag for his hour-long decompression, eyeballed it on board the Seeker, stored it next to his pickup truck's gas tank, moved it around on his garage shelves. As he awaited Kohler's arrival, two thoughts told inside his mind. first, it seemed more certain than ever that the wreck was U-857, which had departed for war in February 1945. And second, perhaps the divers were getting too close, that, crazy as it sounded, maybe the dead crewmen were beginning to fight back. A few hours after finding his garage blown up, Chatterton called Major Gregory Weidenfeld, the Civil Air Patrol historian who had dedicated himself to proving that two everyday civilians in a private plane had sunk a U-boat off New Jersey in 1942. "Listen, Greg," Chatterton said. "We found a hydrostatic test date that proves the wreck sailed sometime after April 15, 1944. That excludes the chance that this is your U-boat. I'm really sorry." For a moment, Chatterton believed he could hear Weidenfeld struggling to compose himself. He could not remember a time when he had met someone so loyal to the memories of the slighted. "Thank you, John," Weidenfeld said. "That means there's another U-boat out there you'll have to find." A few days later, Chatterton received word that his friend, the U-boat ace Carl Friedrich Merton, had died at age 87. The news was not unexpected, as Merton had been ill for some time. But Chatterton knew that Merton's passing, together with his own goodbye to Weidenfeld, meant that a chapter in the diver's quest had closed. For a year, Chatterton, Kohler, and Yerga had considered U-158, via the Civil Air Patrol, and U-851, via Merton's information about his colleague Weingärtner, as the likeliest solutions to the mystery. They had cut their research teeth on these theories and had considered the men friends. Weather and scheduling prevented the seeker from returning to the Yoo-Hoo until July 31st. 2 months after the season's first trip. The divers practically had to sit on their hands to contain themselves when the boat finally departed for the wreck. This would be the trip when Packer and Gatto would begin to make their haul from the diesel motor room. The next morning, Chatterton and Kohler splashed and headed toward the sub's forward compartments, areas they still thought likely to yield identifying artifacts. As before, Chatterton studied the debris field, quieting his mind to acclimate his eyes to the shapes of order. In the commander's quarters, lying in plain view, he spotted a pair of binoculars. "I've been here a dozen times, and there were no binoculars in here," Chatterton thought. "There's no way I would have missed that." Chatterton lifted the binoculars to his mask. Some optics were missing, and much was encrusted in sea growth. He placed the piece in his bag. If the pair had belonged to the commander, perhaps his name lay inscribed underneath the muck. The remainder of Chatterton's search produced little. All the while he thought about how poetic it was to have recovered binoculars in a dive dedicated to seeing. Kohler continued to dig in the non-commissioned officer's quarters. He had been meticulous in avoiding the closet in which the crewman's shoes lay neatly arranged, as well as other areas near the compartment's abundant human remains. In a silt pile he spotted what appeared to be a bowl and brought it to his mask for inspection. It took just a moment for Kohler to realize he was holding a skull. Silt poured from the eye sockets and nasal cavity. A year ago he might have panicked and flung the skull back into the debris. Today he held it and looked into its eyes. "I'm going to do my best to figure out your name," Kohler said aloud. "Your family should know where you are." It was time to leave the wreck. He took the skull and gently placed it in such a way as to allow it to look out over the compartment and its mates. Topside, Chatterton and Kohler washed the binoculars. The apparatus was unmarked. Now they could do no more than await the arrival of Packer and Gatto, who had gone to work inside the promising diesel motor room. An hour later, that team climbed the ladder. Packer's goodie bag bulged. He opened the mesh container and removed a pressure gauge the size of a dinner plate, one of the instruments Chatterton and Kohler had seen in books stamped with a U-boat's identity.
The divers pressed in for a closer look. Etched on the gauge's aluminum face was the eagle and swastika. The rest of the face, however, contained only generic words and numerals. Packer wiped the gauge's body. It nearly crumbled in his hands. As with the torpedo room tags, this instrument had been constructed with the cheap metal porridge used by Germany during its late war raw material shortage. The implication was grave. Other artifacts inside the diesel motor room, including identifying tags, were probably made of the same low-grade materials and had likely not survived the ocean environment. Ripping currents made short work of most second dives. That night, as the Seeker cut through the blue-black Atlantic on her way back to Brielle, few of the divers found themselves with much to say. In the wheelhouse, while Nagel muttered, "This goddamned U-boat," Chatterton made a short entry in his logbook. It read, "Where to next?" The Seeker made 4 trips to the U-boat over the next 6 weeks. Packer and Gatto continued their work inside the open portion of the diesel motor room. They gathered beautiful and interesting artifacts, a gauge panel, plastic tags, even a telegraph, the instrument used to signal orders like, "All stop, full ahead, and dive." All the marks were generic. None identified the wreck. Further access into the compartment was blocked by a massive steel pipe that lay angled in the narrow walkway between the 2 diesel engines. Kohler recognized this pipe as an escape trunk, a vertical tunnel with an interior ladder through which crewmen could flee a sinking U-boat. Now wedged between the engines and reaching from floor to ceiling, the escape trunk blocked any further penetration into the diesel motor room and the adjoining electric motor room. The loss did not seem severe. If the smorgasbord of items Packer and Gatto had thus far recovered revealed nothing about the U-boat's identity, it was unlikely that the remainder of these technical rooms held the answer. Chatterton and Kohler devoted their dives to the U-boat's forward section. They recovered various artifacts, bowls, cups, shoes, gauges, not a bit of which contained identification. Chatterton pulled 2 gems from the wreck, museum-quality pieces that drew gasps from his fellow divers. One of them, lying fully exposed in an area Chatterton had combed a dozen times before, was a surgeon's kit, a collection of stainless steel medical instruments, complete with instructional diagrams, printed in still brilliant red and black inks, on linen canvases. None of it, however, revealed the wreck's identity. "You guys can have all these instruments," Chatterton told the other divers. "I'll keep the diagrams for my house." "Christ, John, that surgeon's kit is a gorgeous find. One of a kind," someone said. "You can't give it away." "I'm looking to identify the wreck," Chatterton replied. "The kit doesn't do it. It's yours." On the next trip, Chatterton recovered the chronometer, the U-boat's precision clock, from the commander's quarters. It was another major score. As with the surgeon's kit, he had found the chronometer lying in the open in an area of the commander's quarters he had searched repeatedly. Topside, he inspected the handsome instrument for evidence of the wreck's identity. Except for the markings of the eagle and swastika, there was none. Chatterton moved to throw overboard the chronometer's wooden box. "What the hell are you doing?" Kohler asked, rushing forward. "The box tells us nothing," Chatterton said. "It's a spectacular find. Are you crazy? That's a career find." "That's not what's important." "Give me the clock in the box," Kohler said. "I got a restoration guy. Give it to me and I'll make it beautiful for your house."
"Whatever you want, Richie."
"Christ, John, what's going on with you?"
Riding back to Brielle that night, Chatterton told Kohler what was going on with him. He had begun the dive season with a ferocious optimism, certain that his brand of hard work, preparation, and instinct, his artistry, would pay off in a positive identification of the wreck. Now, 4 months and 6 trips later, he found himself with all kinds of crazy thoughts. He worried for the first time that a greenhorn diver would climb the seeker's ladder with an identification